Welcome to another episode of The Best in Tech. Today's episode, we are talking to traffic host come Greek geek about insane traffic and his favorite technology. My name is Rehard. You're listening to The Best in Tech. Stay tuned. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to another episode of The Best in Tech. I'm sitting here with Aki Anastasio. How are you doing, Aki?
Rehard, it's really nice to see you. How are you doing?
Yeah, very good, man. Yeah. Very good. Thank you for coming on the podcast and talking some cool tech today.
It's welcome. I was trying to think as you were talking there, how long you and I have been, you know, covering the tech scene.
Sure.
It's been a long time, eh?
It's been a long time.
Just trying to think how far back we go, you know?
Early 2000s, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
I vividly remember that trip to Greece, the island of Kos. Do you remember that?
Oh, my word, with HP.
HP, yeah.
Remember they were showing off these massive printers that they weren't even 3D printers. They were just printing large sheets of color in a poster size.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, man, it was
fantastic. And you think about that, and they were talking about how detailed their color printers were, and just look at where we are today. It's quite astonishing.
And now home printing isn't really a thing anymore. You go to a big, large printing facility to get those prints, right?
Exactly.
I mean, you can still buy printers, but who really invests in printers?
No, not at all. I think people, I mean, offices and that sort of thing. I look at our office, for example. We still use a lot of paper, and you know, people still like to have that hard copy. But you're quite right, you know. And the notion of the digital paperless office, I don't know if that it doesn't apply.
No, it doesn't.
We're using as much paper now, I'm sure, as we used say 10 years ago.
And especially with all these regulations, you need physical copies these days.
No, exactly, exactly.
But we digress. We're not really talking about printing. Printing is outdated tech,
yes,
in my opinion.
So 2010. You know?
But you've kind of made your name on radio as the traffic guy.
I mean, yes.
Most people in Joburg know you on 702 in the morning shows. Now you're on the afternoon show. And I've always been fascinated about the way that you guys report on traffic and kind of the technology that goes in behind it. Would you mind telling me a little bit about the kind of stuff you use and what goes into getting people the traffic information?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, Rehard, for 20 years when I started my career, we used to fly in a helicopter and we used to be connected with HF radios and reporting from the sky. It used to go, you know, the radio used to transmit from one transmitter to another, and we used to have repeaters across the city so we could get the signal back to the station.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's how we were transmitting. So we would fly over an area and say, da, 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 the helicopter at the moment, this is the traffic up here. And then in the helicopter itself, we had different radios. We had the radios from different traffic departments. We used to fly with the traffic officer, and they would, you know, they would press, we didn't even have cell phones in those days. They would radio the different traffic departments on the ground saying, Bravo 10, Bravo 10, do you have any problems to report? And then everything was, you know, the communication was done via radio networks in those days. And then, of course, when cell phones came out, you know, we had a long, hard look at this helicopter that was costing us thousands and thousands of rands, even though we owned it.
Every day, you guys
we
went
used to
out
fly
every morning.
2.5 hours morning, 2.5 hours in the afternoons, 3 hours sometimes.
Must have been fantastic as a job, though.
Oh, man. It's just like, it's the best thing ever. You know, people used to tell me, you're not scared to fly in the helicopter. And what amazes me is that Bell Jet Ranger helicopter that we used in those days is the same helicopter that used the same design for like 30 years, that same helicopter. If you look at a 747 aircraft, they came out in the late 60s, and they lasted for decades. The same, you know, shape and the same kind of technology. Look, they improved on the avionics, and they improved on things like the engines and that sort of thing. But the actual shape and the core structure of the aircraft was the same.
Yeah.
And you know, I'll never forget the year. It was when the dollar went to 14 rand or something, and I had to review my yearly budgets. And I went to the board and I said, look, this is how much I need for the next year, because every 5,000 hours you'd have to replace the blades of the helicopter.
Oh, yeah, that's a big cost.
And it was, you know, it would have cost us $35,000 per blade to replace. So I had to go to the board and I said, listen, I need an extra $1.5 million, you know, we have to bring these in from the States. Rand dollar exchange rate. They said, sorry, we're making this tool a redundant tool. And it was at a time where cell phones were starting to grow, and we were now starting to use cell phone technology. So it was interesting, the more mobile people became, we had a call center in the old days where people used to phone in and say, hey, I've just come past this accident, here it is. And it's evolved even more since then. So now on the traffic desk, we typically have you know, like four computer screens. We're monitoring, you know,
with real-time feeds, obviously, camera feeds and that type of thing, right?
So we got the Sanrail feeds.
Yes.
They've got cameras all over the place.
There's a public version of that, too. I think that there you can access it. I had a link somewhere. That's very interesting to see as well.
Yes. No, there's so much data available. There's a lot of companies that are using analytics to calculate delay times from one point to another. And, of course, everyone has a cell phone, so Google is collecting all of that data.
Yeah.
They're overlaying that on live traffic feeds with heat maps, for example. You got, you know, people like Waze, for example, who do fantastic stuff, which is more a social kind of thing. And Google, of course, owns Waze as well. So, you know, you've got access to all of this data. You've got access to WhatsApp, which is now, you know. So what we've had to do is whenever new technologies come out, we've had to, like, bring them in. And what we essentially do is, if you can imagine these fruits, I call the fruits the different sources of information that come as like an orange or an apple. And what we have to do is we have to put them all into one blender, make a smoothie, which we serve to the listeners that tastes good. So you've got to make sense of all the data because there's so much data out there. And
nice little breakfast smoothie first thing in the morning.
Yeah,
I like
exactly.
That.
Or an afternoon smoothie. So there's tons of information that comes in. And remember, we're also using a lot of older technologies like SMS. People still SMS us.
People
are sending us WhatsApp. People
so it's
are
a lot of crowdsource versus you guys going out tweets, and seeing what's happening out there.
Yeah. And you know, the great thing about where the modern world is going with the technology is that the technology is a lot more accurate than what it was when we were flying.
Yeah, and you could see a lot more in a single glance than you could do with one single chopper flying around.
Exactly. However, the one thing that I still cannot do accurately enough, you know, with analog versus digital, and I use this for people, and I tell them that when you're sitting on top of the Eiffel Tower – and you're looking around and you're looking at Paris and you can smell the croissants, the digital side of social media and the way we gather information right now doesn't give us that same sense of reality. But, you know, listeners are sending us pictures. People are responding a lot quicker. So you do have a different kind of information. And in some senses, it is a bit more richer. But the authenticity of it is sometimes questionable because you've got a lot of people who don't give you accurate information,
for sure,
you see.
For sure.
So if you can't see it yourself, but you start picking up those trends on those heat maps, and that's where you really get a real sense of where traffic is going. And I'll tell you a funny story. You know, you talk about those heat maps, and I always use it. You know, if you look at the cradle on the weekend, right, Saturday, Sunday.
Yes.
It's just one red loop around that whole area.
On the Strava heat map,
On the Strava. No, on the Google one as well.
Google Earth.
On the Google one as well. And because Strava's using Google Maps, if I'm not mistaken. But it's all cyclists and runners.
Mm.
And you're thinking, and you know, that's the interesting thing. Google cannot distinguish between a cyclist and a motorist. So it's overlaying that data on the map and showing that as traffic data.
And everybody's avoiding that area because they think it's a massive traffic jam.
But it's actually cyclists using and tracking their times.
Yeah, I suppose there is definitely always room for technology to improve.
Yeah.
But what I'm most excited about is satellites. I think, you know, we talk about tech, everyday tech all the time, but personal satellites to a degree, or satellites that a company like 702's traffic department could send up, have it hovering over Earth, and every day being able to see those live maps. I mean, I'm sure it might not be financially viable, but you'll have a company offering such a service. I mean, have you guys experimented with satellite imagery before?
No, I actually haven't. I haven't, Rehod, but, you know, it does make a lot of sense. You know, if you look at the cost of satellites today compared to what they were, say, you know, 10 years ago, 2 decades ago, you know, you couldn't afford them.
Mm-hmm.
But now I think, you know, reasonable-sized companies can afford to send satellites into the orbit and use them, and, you know, their lifespan is pretty decent.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's an option, but I think that when you start talking to accountants and telling them, I want this and I want that, then they're going to say it's probably not feasible. But I think if the country as a whole took, you know, I don't know, the National Roads Agency took out a satellite to monitor traffic and that sort of thing, they would do that.
Oh, that would make sense, yeah.
And they would have to, you know, because we're entering an interesting era with cars and self-driving cars and all these kind of things that you've got to look at, question the current infrastructures that we have and all the planned roads that, you know, local government has got coming up. I know they're planning another PWV road, but you look at the Gululis interchange, which is possibly one of the biggest interchanges in the Southern Hemisphere. It handles 300,000 cars a day.
Wow.
Yeah. So how much longer can that interchange handle that kind of volume? Mm-hmm. When you look at the numbers of people moving to urban areas, you know, so traffic congestion is becoming a real problem, and there's not much space to put more roads.
No, definitely. I mean, and self-driving cars, that was a very nice segue into the next segment, actually. I mean, there's been a lot of news recently about self-driving cars, especially the accident where somebody was killed.
Yes.
The first death with an automatic vehicle. I mean, what is your opinion on self-driving cars? Obviously, the technology is fantastic, but there are still some shortcomings.
Look, there are, but you know, the reality with self-driving cars is that they're here to stay, and I think that we mustn't let an incident like the one that happened. And I've actually seen the video. Have you seen the video
of
it? It's actually quite eerie.
It's very eye-opening, and
eerie. So there was obviously some kind of failure with hardware or a sensor. And I think it's an industry where they're learning things every day. But if it was a real driver that was driving, would they have prevented that is the question. How many deaths are self-driving cars currently preventing? Because if you look at the data, the reality is that it's still far safer self-driving cars than human cars. And I find it quite interesting when you look at states like Arizona, for example, where previously they had you had to have a driver behind the wheel as a safety precaution. Now you don't have to have that. The law's been lifted. So
they're taking it seriously.
No, absolutely. There's no doubt about it that self-autonomous driving vehicles are going to be going mainstream, and they're going to be part of our lives, whether we like it or not. And I'm very happy for that technology. And it's interesting how much money people are putting into this. You know, you look at Toyota's budget in that they've set up a specific unit in San Francisco with a budget of $3 billion, to try and find, put money in autonomous driving. And I think that everybody that has got any kind of relationship in this industry is involved. You know, even companies like Bosch in Germany that, you know, people have heard Bosch, they think they do drills, but actually they're heavily involved
in
self-driving cars. Yeah. And you look at the chip manufacturers like NVIDIA, for example, and the technologies that are going behind that. So I'm very excited. And when I was at CES earlier this year, it was quite amazing to see the partnership between Lyft, BMW, and Aptiv. I think Aptiv is one of the companies that does the software for self-driving cars. Aptiv. And they had about, a fleet of about 36 cars with BMW and Lyft, which is Uber's competitor in America. And you could literally call up your ride from the convention center, and they had 20 preset destinations that this car would take you to. So they had drivers behind, but they weren't driving. It was all self-driving. So the technology is there. It's there. It's ready to be turned on. And I think it's the human paradigm shift that has to happen to say, okay, I trust this technology. And once that trust happens, I think it's going to be the game changer.
Yeah, the technology is beyond amazing.
It's
And technically, if you look at, any technology that we as a civilization has developed, within that framework, we can see that self-driving cars would be a perfect way for people to get around. But we have variables that I think is kind of the challenge now.
Yes.
In South Africa, pedestrians is going to be a huge challenge.
Oh, yes.
The cars need to obviously be able to respond much quicker because I've been kind of keeping an eye on pedestrian movements when they walk over on a red light, when the little man is green for them or red for them.
Correct.
A lot of people ignore all of those things.
Yeah.
And once we can get to a point where our technology would be able to kind of preempt these things, obviously with the right LIDARs or radar technology, it would be able to then see somebody moving, see their intent because they're moving at a certain speed in a direction that could collide with your car's path. That calculation could happen quickly, car slows down, accident averted.
And, I think the differentiator for that kind of thing is going to be 5G. Because the latency and the speeds that the technology is going to react to each other. A guy was explaining to me the difference between 4G and 5G in terms of autonomous driving. He's saying that when a vehicle's reaction time on 4G, it's literally a few hundredths of a millisecond difference between the two technologies, but that short space and latency of 5G is quick enough for the car to have that command quicker to be able to apply brakes to avoid knocking a pedestrian or something down. So 5G is the critical component in this technology for it to happen.
For sure. And I also think the backhaul between a lot of these vehicles, I think that is probably one of the most important parts of any autonomous vehicle industry, is these cars need to talk to each other. If a car, five cars up ahead, sees something, all the other cars need to get that information very quickly to say that there's a hazard, there's a pothole, or whatever that may be. And then eventually we'll get to a place where the roads are a very safe place to be, because humans aren't in charge of the big machinery that could kill people.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you hit on a very good point there when you said that when they start talking to each other. And it's so important for these technologies to talk to each other.
Yeah,
I was reading a fascinating article the other day, you know, coming back to the traffic stuff we were talking about. And they were saying that all of these traffic app platforms are slowly kind of defeating the purpose of sorting our traffic situation out, because they're not all necessarily talking to each other, but they're suggesting different routes. And they're suggesting different routes based on data. So if there's an accident on the highway, it will send you along back routes. Now the back routes are becoming a problem.
Congested, yeah.
Because, you know, the other apps don't know, hey, this, you know, Google Maps has told us to come here, but, you know, Apple Maps is telling us to come here as well. But Apple and Google Maps don't necessarily talk to each other and share their data. They're creating more congestion.
That's interesting.
And confusion.
That is very interesting. Look, I think the AI behind this too, that now we're talking about another factor in all of this.
Yeah.
We need the machine learning behind this to go, okay, dissect the information, whether it's autonomous vehicles or just mapping. You know, here's the data. I'm kind of analyzing it. 0.5 seconds later, it's got a solution to this problem that it needs to figure out, and then direct people whichever way that needs to be.
But, you know, the one thing that blows me away with these self-driving cars is those radars and those sensors that are on top that are reading every bit of information as this car is in motion. It's picking up Rayhot walking across there, that cyclist, and kind of trying to put in some predictive analytics as
creating
to who's going to do
see,
what,
yeah,
its
yeah.
own map. I mean, that for me just blows me away.
And just to think, what's it, when we first met almost 20 years ago now, the technology we were dealing with seemed so futuristic. I mean, cell phones was not
yeah,
a smart
absolutely.
Cell phones weren't smartphones, but they were fantastic. I mean, text messaging Snake on your Nokia, it was incredible.
Yeah.
Even the game technology back then, I mean, we had relatively mundane graphics cards in comparison to what we have today, but we were very happy with it. We were very happy with this growth in technology we were seeing every year.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And look at where we are now.
And now we complain about you know, the speeds on the internet and how slow things can get, but we forget those dial-up modems that we had. And those card modems, do you ever want to have one
yes.
of those?
PCMCIA.
You slide in, you slide in. I think we got, what was it, 14.4.
Yeah. I think I had a 56K one.
I had a 9600.
Eventually. Yeah, the
one of the initial ones. It was crazy.
And now this is my favorite thing to reminisce about, but fiber. You got fiber, right?
Yes. Oh.
It was a complete life changer for me. I mean, as soon as I always knew bandwidth is what I desperately needed. I mean, as any geek
yes.
does. But as soon as you have 50, 100, a gigabit download speeds capability into your house, I mean, it changes so much what you can do and how you consume data.
Do you know, I had such a massive jump. Eh? So I went from a 10 meg ADSL line, and I went straight into 200 up, 200 down. I thought,
beautiful.
You know what, I'm just going to enjoy it, okay? And people said, oh, you're crazy. You're not going to need that much speed, you know?
You can always do with more speed.
You can always do with more speed. I love it because it's there, you
yeah,
know.
Exactly.
And it's
like a sports car.
It's like a sports
when you push on the throttle, it's going
to
go.
Exactly. And it's just wonderful to play that the instantaneousness of it. It's really a game changer.
It is.
And I also think that, you know, it's important to be with the right ISP so that you don't have you know, too many users on the same line, you know, in the same network, and the contention ratios are important. Latency.
Fortunately, with fiber, it's less of an issue than with copper, because obviously fiber, there's so much capacity in the lines that you can play with. The company shouldn't really be throttling and doing that kind of thing. That's why you need to look out for the right company.
But you need to look. You know, it's quite interesting. We should do a show on fiber itself, because you know a lot of these complexes are now signing contracts with companies to put the fiber into the complex, right?
And then they're bound to it.
And then they're bound to it, and then they offer them, you know, like crappy speeds, or it's not a GPON network, or, you know, whatever the terminologies that they use.
Trying to make a buck, basically, off the communities.
But, you know, I firmly believe when you look at, you know, companies like Vumatel, for example, Metro Fiber, to a degree, I think provide a good service as well. But you got to be very careful as a complex who you sign your deal with. Ask them questions. And most people don't know these things. And also your service provider. I hear so many variants and complaints about different service providers. But I must say, you know, I've been very, very
happy. Who are you using? Are you using Cool Ideas?
Okay. I've got them in my business and I've got them in at home now. They're just amazing. And their support is amazing as well.
Yeah, a lot of good things. I'm a big fan of Cell C. Because I had a package when I signed up for my first fiber installation that included everything. And the deal was good. And my strategy at the beginning also was Cell C is a new player. They probably wouldn't have as many guys. So yes. I would get good service. And it's a best thing I've done, because I'm still get incredibly good service from them.
Absolutely.
I've got two fiber lines that I'm using on two premises, and I mean, just dealing with them is fantastic. Not that I actually have to deal with them, because everything is
working. Yeah.
My speeds are always consistent.
That's great.
A geek, I always test, I always check, because I want to.
Yeah.
Again, you know, like you said, you must check out who your provider is, but I guess, you know, between Cool Ideas and Cell C, those are two good, solid options.
I hear good words about them. Yeah.
No, I'm very happy. I'm actually testing a 1 gig line at the moment because
I saw your tweet. It was insane.
I'm testing a Netgear XR500 router. This router is about $5,000. It's a gaming router with a Dumo OS, so it's a proper operating system on this router. I mean, it looks like a massive. It's the size of my MacBook 15-inch keyboard section. It's big. But yeah, having a gig, my mind is blown. I mean, there's a lot of things that it doesn't really matter whether you have a big connection or not. Mm. Like most things won't make a difference whether you have a 200 or 1 gig. But it comes down to multiple users on that line. And then also if you are connecting to really fast game servers, for example. I downloaded a Battlefield 1 64 gigabyte complete game installation with all the patches. I think it took me less than an hour to do that.
That's amazing.
I didn't time it because it
blows my mind.
I wanted to time it, and it was done when I got back to my PC less than an hour. I mean, obviously, it was pulling from a very fast game server, probably local. Yeah. That's really what you want.
But, you know, Rekhod, you talk about the speeds. You know, even from an entertainment point of view, you talk about gaming. Last night, I was testing an Apple 4K Apple TV, and I've got a 4K LG panel, and I watched the movie, and I just pressed the button. It just instantly started.
Yeah.
And a 4K movie must be pulling about 4 gigs of data hour quite easily. And that picture quality was amazing. And
instant, on-demand, no buffering. I think fiber has given that to us. And now when you get to, I think 50 to 100 meg is a sweet spot for anybody coming into the market.
Yes.
And at that point, granted, if you don't have like 10 people on your home network, that instantaneous will be fantastic. It will be there.
That's
I love it. Yeah, fiber is my favorite thing of the decade.
Yes.
That is for sure. Now let's talk a little bit about other technology that you love, that is your favorite. As a tech reporter as well, I mean, the other hats that you wear is very much a tech geek. You're very much in the going on as well, what's happening outside there. What has been some of the highlights that you've seen recently? I mean, we've spoken about autonomous vehicles, and you did mention a little bit of Internet of Things. But what other things have you seen out there that's amazing?
Well, you know what? I just to touch on the IoT stuff. I love the IoT stuff at the moment, and I love the flexibility that it gives me. You know, in my home at the moment, I've got my air conditioner connected. I've got a sensor in my geyser that I can control the temperature and you know, these are like real practical examples, and I'm going to show you a picture of it, because I know we can't show the viewers, but I use this product called Carbon Track, and with Carbon Track I've put a couple of lights on, but if I look at my geyser appliance, it's currently off, and it only is scheduled to go on between 4 and 5:30 every day.
That is very cool. So this is something that sits in line,
it just sits on
between
your geyser.
The power.
Yes. Exactly. And through that, I can control the temperature of the geyser. I can get insights.
What product is this? Where can one? This looks pretty incredible.
No, it's very cool. And then it gives me a monthly
report, a monthly
breakdown analysis of how much electricity my geyser's used, etc. And
it's
a product called Carbon Track, and it works really, really well.
Where do you get the sensors? I mean, is Carbon Track? Do you
find
them
come
in
and
South
install
Africa?
It.
They
you'll find them in the
on the Google.
They're online. You find them at Builders Warehouse and these kind of places.
Oh, so it's a pretty consumer grade technology.
Very much so. And this is what I love about the Internet of Things. And then I've got another little device that I love telling people about. It's called the Netatmo. Have you heard of Netatmo?
Mm-mm.
It's a fantastic company. So Netatmo is they use like the weather stations. They do the Internet of Things well. So I've got a sensor in my house that picks up CO2 emissions, picks up any change in temperature, noise, for example. And there's another station that's outside as well that tells me the outside temperature. There's also a rain gauge that I've put in. And this rain gauge, you know, gives me reports every single hour when there is rain, you know. So if you look at last week, for example, where we had the heavy rains across Gauteng. Oh,
there we go. That's
all the rain there. And that goes hour by hour. And
how does it catch it? Does it catch the water, or does it just measure it?
It's a clever little thing. It sits in your patio, and I've put it against the wall. And inside, it's got a sensor, so as soon as it gets to a certain volume, you hear it click, and then it starts collecting again until it reaches a certain...
Oh, so it measures the amount of water per time. Yeah.
Per time, and it obviously measures the mils as it goes through. And then it sends it to the other device, the mothership inside the house, and then on my smartphone, I can be anywhere in the world,
awesome.
I can see, you know, there's been rain. And that stuff, I just love that stuff.
Yeah,
you know?
Me too.
It gives you such amazing insights into your home and that we didn't have before.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, one of the other things I like, there's two things that really fascinate me. There's a security side of things too, obviously with full-on alarm kind of things that you can connect. I'm not talking about the stuff that's connected to your security camera. I'm talking about the stuff that you can access. And then also the video cameras. I find that those two things for me is kind of the first place a lot of people are going to jump on board with the IoT. Get in-home security, maybe check what's in your fridge, but cameras and security is a big thing.
But you know, you talk about the security. I bought this fascinating little gadget from Amazon about 3-4 years ago. Now I've had the traditional security that, you know, you put in your alarm system, you put in your code and it goes beep, 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 and you leave your house, right? So you take this module and you just plug it in. There's videos on YouTube. You literally connect a couple of cables together and it's got a Wi-Fi sensor on it and it talks to my network. So from my phone, I can take my old traditional alarm system and I can activate it and deactivate it from here.
That's cool. So it uses those old IO ports on the
alarm box
and that you can that's cool. So you can retrofit any old or most old alarm boxes.
Exactly.
That is very cool.
Yeah, so you can do a lot of stuff with IoT.
I think that's kind of also the thing, right? You want your IoT to be able to integrate with existing technology, because we're not there where everybody can just go out and buy a new tech and then the house is connected. What is your thoughts on VR? Have you played with the HTC Vive at all?
I have played with the Vive, and VR for me, you know, we talk about our careers and how long we've been. If I had to analyze the top 10 wow things that have happened in technology, VR is right up there with a wow technology. And how I measure a wow technology is the reaction that you get from people. I remember the first iPad that came into the country. I had the first iPad. I waited for this guy. It's just an amazing story. I was on the radio on the weekend, and it was opening in New York, and I got a call from a guy who was standing in the queue, a South African guy, who went there specifically to get an iPad. And he literally flew to New York and he was going to fly back. So we got him on the radio and I said, please get me one as well. So he got me one as well. And, you know, that's how I got the first. But with VR, whichever generation you try the glasses on, it's that wow experience for anybody. I've tried it on my mom who's 70, or my dad who's 77. Anybody that you put those glasses on, as basic as they are, and I'm talking about the Samsung ones, you know.
The cardboard type thing. I mean, even the cardboard ones. Yeah.
When people go and they go, oh, wow, it's so real. The reactions that people have is quite astonishing to a technology. Mm. So when you start playing with the high-end stuff, like the one you've just spoken about, the Vive, and you know, the other ones that are out there, you know, the Microsoft lenses as well, you can understand how big this technology has potential to become. And yet, we all get a sense that a lot of people think that, you know, it's going to be a technology that's not going to last too long. But when you look at the amount of money that Facebook is plowing into this and the big companies that are plowing into it, you can understand there's going to be a tipping point where VR is very much part of our lives, especially in the gaming industry.
Yeah? Oh, yeah. Gaming generally pushes the stuff on tech. I mean, if you look at processing power, graphics card power, peripherals, gaming seems to be the place where people kind of experiment with the technology because they can push it, and the gamers are, you know, they're pretty brutal in their honesty about certain tech.
Yeah.
But VR is one of those things that I think it's going to change the way we do so many things on a human level. Like connection is one thing, but I mean, look at how surgeons can use it to do remote operations.
Yes.
You can use it to help people with mental disorders. I've read a lot of interesting papers on that, or people that have fears of certain things.
100%.
We are in an incredible space and time.
Yeah, we are. And I think that, you know, you look at the numbers, you look at VR. VR is very much the kind of entertainment side of it. But AR is the one that's going to be the game changer. Yes. That you were just referring to a second ago. You know, I mean, I saw another application for augmented reality where they put on the goggles on. I think that they were using the Microsoft HoloLens one.
Yeah, that's a great product.
It's a fantastic product. And this guy had access to an entire server room, right? So you think of your IT manager, you've got your servers in the cloud. So they had a visual of all their servers, and you can physically go up to each server with your hands using these glasses and the sensors and start adjusting the servers, turning a server down, increasing the capacity of one server. Cool. So the applications are endless. You know, I saw another one, which, and I tried this out. Where was it? I think it was at an Audi conference. Yeah. So you put these glasses on, okay, and it was in a factory, and they had like little red lines. So you used – it was a learning thing to show me as a factory worker on how to pack specific boxes. So it was an educational thing. Yes. And you literally had to go through the different steps. Say, lift this package, and you can lift it up, you know, virtually and put it in another box, adjust that computer, and it was just worked perfectly. And I learned how – you know, processing automation plant worked by just using these goggles just for a few minutes. But so the possibilities are endless, right?
No, I absolutely love it.
And I love that technology.
I absolutely love it. Are you looking forward to Ready Player One coming out soon, the movie? Because that is going to be – that's going to put everybody on the AR-VR map.
Yes. I think so. And you're going to get lots of other – I think it's going to open the door for a lot more to come.
Oh, yeah.
And once that happens, you know, you know, people say that, you know, AR and VR is going to go the same route that 3D did, and I don't think so. It's a completely different
technology.
It's
a completely different beast, yeah. I mean, if I've spent a lot of hours with HTC Vive on my head, trying to immerse myself completely in this. And yes, some of the technologies and some of the video is still a little bit, you know, still a little bit entry level.
Yes.
But once you've played with it and once you've kind of pushed these things to its boundaries and just experience it for what it is.
Yeah.
You can kind of appreciate all these applications for it.
Would you say that HTC is the Vive is the leader in this market?
It's in my opinion is one of the best ones.
Yes.
I haven't played as much. I haven't spent as much time with the others. But HoloLens to me is probably better in the sense that you can have both. You can have AR and VR overlay with the HTC Vive. I haven't seen the new one yet, but with HTC Vive, it's kind of more about the VR.
Yeah.
Although I do think the HTC Vive Pro coming out this year, I mean, it's got the cameras in front, so I think there would be an application that will allow you to get the overlay.
Mm.
Although you're not physically, you're still looking through lenses, so there will still be a little bit of a digital element where the HoloLens is you physically seeing.
And, you know, the price point's coming down, you know, and, you know, like one of the pioneers in the market, Oculus. You know, not many people talk about Oculus anymore, but they're still doing a lot of stuff.
And they've got some pretty funky glasses now, which
look
like sunglasses.
I mean,
they're not as big as the other guys.
And I see like even guys like Intel are dabbling with similar kind of technologies, although it's a different version of virtual reality. You know, when you look at Google Glass, for example, it was very much ahead of its time at the time and not practical in the sense that the battery life wasn't great and what it could do. But I was looking at Intel's new prototype that they're launching that you can see, you know, certain things in the glasses and how they've adjusted it with our human behavior to do different things where you tilt your head and that sort of thing. So they've thought about a lot of these kind of things, and I'm sure that you're going to see lots of different applications coming out.
I'm really looking forward to it, and I'm not joking when I say this, but once we get to a point where you can implant that kind of thing in your eye, to me that I would be looking forward to that very much.
As
somebody that wears glasses, you know, not only to improve eyesight potentially, but to have that digital layer over everything you see, I think it could be scary and pretty fantastic if you can connect to the internet at the same time.
But you know, now you're talking about a different realm, which really fascinates me. You know, you talk about the singularity and how far are we from actually using these implantable technologies to improve our human intelligence? And you look at the stuff that guys talk about, and, you know, you think, oh, it's so sci-fi, you know, it's not going to happen. It's the stuff we see in movies. Doesn't it amaze you that the stuff we saw in movies like 15 years ago was like, oh, wow, this stuff's never going to happen, and it's real. It's now. It's happening now.
That stuff now.
So when these guys say to you, like 2035, 2040 is when the singularity is going to happen, where you're going to have machines like embedded in us and assisting us with our everyday intelligence, dude, that's like in our lifetime. It's like 15 years away. It's like 10 years away from happening in reality. And that's, for me, is so exciting and so scary at the same time.
It is. But isn't it fantastic to live in a time where we can see, we remember analog.
Yes.
And we can see the most advanced tech. You know, we can see the reality of it in our lifetimes. Like, yeah, you absolutely. Said, I'm a big fan of future thinking like that. It it's exciting. And as a geek, as somebody that appreciates the tech, you know, I just want to know how it works. I want to understand the fundamentals. And I just want to.
Exactly. And you know what I watched the other day that I hadn't seen when I first watched it? It was one of those movies, Tom Cruise, Minority Report.
Oh, yes.
All right? When they have all these predictive models of crime, for example. Mm. Okay?
Oh, yeah,
and he's putting the stuff in. And that stuff's happening now. Like in the U.S., they're using stats, normal daily stats that these guys have got coming in to start putting in predictive models on where the next crime is going to happen. It's like already happening. And it's pretty accurate. Just on the data that you've got, putting it through some sort of intelligence and analytics, you can start predicting patterns and do something about it before it actually happens.
That is an interesting, I guess, the other side of things, or the other side of data, which I guess is both a good and a bad thing. I mean, we're seeing this with Facebook now. But
yes.
What, you know, having all this data is going to allow us to do so much. But who holds the keys to that data? Now,
that's
what we've seen
challenge.
With Facebook is... Yeah. Those guys that have the keys are they innocent and they didn't know what happened, which I don't think so, you know, or are they just selling data to the highest bidder or trying to do so strategically?
Well, you know, there's two things to it. I mean, what the evidence is showing us that the data helped change an election, and if it gets in the wrong hands, it can be used to do bad stuff. And, you know, we don't have to, you know, look at the Russians and all that stuff that has just happened now. But then there's a good side of data. You know, if you're starting to pick up certain trends on what people are talking about, measuring anger levels, emotion levels, and what people are searching on Google, for example, and you start, you know, putting the data together and you're starting to emerge with a certain picture and you're thinking, well, here's a plot, a terrorism plot, or whatever the case may be, then you can act and do something about it. But again, the data that we have and the technology that we're using will manipulate us. You know, I don't know if you watched this Darren Brown documentary.
I saw the teaser on Netflix.
I actually watched it. And what they did was they took a group of people and they basically they used the power of persuasion, okay, and trying to break down your capacities as a human being to make a specific decision. And, you know, they pushed someone to such a point where they were capable of murdering someone. Pushing someone off a building, not to give too much away from it.
Sure.
But it's all got to do with human emotion. And the reality is that, you know, if you look at the kind of stuff people post on Facebook, that you and I know it's a fake story. Mm. Why are you posting it? And yet people are believing in that sort of thing. There are still people that believe that the moon landings were manipulated,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
So you've got that, and that's human nature. And if people can be manipulated – And Facebook are using the data to do this kind of thing. That, for me, that's very scary.
It is very scary. But I also think we are on that cusp where people don't know. I mean, there's so much happening with data. And people don't know the amount of data that's out there on them being collected. I mean, people, if we fast forward, let's say, 10, 15 years, and kids are brought up with that instinctive education where don't share this online, don't do this on, you know, like within a certain set of parameters that we were brought up with just in the real world, you know, we didn't have the internet to kind of base that kind of stuff around.
Yeah.
I think we'll see a shift, but humanity as a whole, I mean, we're still trying to figure out what, I mean, we know data and big data and all these terms that the companies throw around, but nobody really, well, Facebook, I think this is the first time we've seen something like, whoa, people are going, maybe I should be deleting my Facebook account. Now, that I think could be a bit drastic, because I do see a lot of value in the platform, and we need to see what's going to happen from this.
But Facebook's not going to be the same again after this.
No, they're not. Something is going to have to change. But again, it's opening up the debate with people on the ground saying, you know, should I be posting photos of my kids? Or, you know, all those kind of things that people, you know, at least set it to private if you don't want, you know, the whole world to see.
You know what it is, Rachod, is that, as you correctly said earlier, what is it about us that they know and how are they using it, to sell our information for other purposes. Facebook's one thing. I mean, did you know you've got a Google account, right?
Yeah.
Right. Have you ever looked on your Google locations that you've been on?
I kind of love that about it. I know it's scary. I love that about it.
But most people don't know about it.
Yeah.
They've got this device.
It's kind of hidden, yeah.
But Google knows where you've been to every single day. It's tracking you. When your phone goes with you, it knows that Rehod went to this place at this time. From there, you drove to that place. Mm. Most people don't know about it. But Google knows
your movements.
And I wouldn't be surprised. And I was reading about this Facebook, hack and breach that you're talking about. But the other stuff that Facebook has actual access to on your phone. Now, you're thinking that Facebook, it's an app that you open up and you're basically just, posting some pictures. But Facebook's got access to your phones, got access to the calls that you've made, access to your SMSs, and according to The Guardian, even access to your emails.
That is scary.
So
how much are you signing away when you click that?
How much are you signing
button?
Away? Exactly. And somebody argued the other day, I was talking to a colleague of mine, and they're saying, but why do you want to ban? What's your problem with this whole Facebook thing? Well, I said, I'm angry that the trust has been broken. But what are you paying for Facebook? I'm not paying anything. What are you getting out of it? Well, you're getting connectivity. There's some other great uses that we get out of Facebook. The marketing side of things, the platform that it raises for people to engage with each other. And we forget about those things. And those are great things about Facebook. Yeah. But I'm still angry that I've been lied to as a consumer of Facebook's. But what right do we have to be angry about it when we're not paying for the service?
We're using their platform, yeah. I mean, their terms and conditions are very long if you've dared to read through it. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in there that will never make sense to you.
I mean,
and that's just Facebook. I mean, all these other end-user license agreements we sign. I mean, there's a very funny South Park episode where Cartman signs an Apple iTunes, he was clicking accept, and then a whole bunch of funny, it's not full podcast material, but it is a hilarious episode with repercussions of what could do if you don't read your EULA
100%. And I had an angry call over the weekend, a mate of mine, I'm sure a lot of your friends phone you with tech stuff and everything.
Yeah.
His guy phone, he was so angry with this Facebook thing, he deleted his Facebook account, everything, So now, this person shall remain unnamed, has lost access to all sorts of other things that he used Facebook to sign in with.
Ouch.
So his Spotify account, all the games that you play, your poker account that you play. So Facebook have been very clever with that. They've made it a nice little conduit that you use your Facebook credentials to sign into all of these other things. You delete Facebook and you lose contact with all the other stuff as well.
That's true. They hook you like that.
They hook you in. You tied in. You look at how many apps are connected to your Facebook account next time. That's why
it's scary. Yeah.
I'll never let Facebook do that. Every app that I have, every technology that I have, obviously the games are slightly different. You're playing Scrabble and Friends with Words, but I have a sign in with my email address and my own password. I don't let Facebook control that.
Now, the question is, when you do that, and I never thought of this, but are you giving them access to that application too? I mean, would that realize say that they can actually see what kind of music you listen to?
Absolutely.
All those things. That is scary.
No, Facebook.
And I use that feature all the time. I like it. I think it's great to sign up for a new service, just press one button.
It's very useful. Google does it as well.
Google, again, I use that all the time. I think, as early adopters, we just have to immerse ourselves in this and kind of be the fall guys or be the puppets to test these things.
Here's the thing: the reality is, you can't hide anywhere in this world. Privacy is dead. Forget about it. If you want to be private in this world and think that I'm not going to have a phone, I'm not going to have this, what kind of world are you going to be?
You're shutting yourself
in?
Out from
exactly
from everything.
So you have to kind of blend in with it. Read the rules and protect yourself as much as you can.
Yeah, exactly. But and embrace the technology.
Yeah.
I think it's inevitable that this is going to happen. I mean, just quickly going back to the whole data thing and Facebook. The data is out there. It's going to be out there. Yes, we need to know how to secure this and use it properly. But there can be so much good that comes from this.
Yes.
So much good if we can manage it properly and not screw each other over.
There's I forget the name of the website now, but there's a couple of them around that gives you a visualization as soon as you start searching for something, what happens to your information. And even if you do even if you open up a simple website like CNN, it'll show you. It goes to this server, it bounces, and then that server asks Facebook who you are. Then Facebook sends that to somebody else. And it's like this spider web of data just from one simple search on CNN that is collecting a lot of information about you, including your location, where you are, picking up a profile of you. Just by a simple search, they're getting all of that access. And how these apps sometimes talk to each other and share that information to build up a profile of who you are. It's
scary, but again, we can't have one without the other. We can't have all these cool services without having some sort of data underlying, you know, decision making.
Sorry to interrupt you, but this is where this gets so exciting for me. This is the big data. And you look at the stuff that's happening on the medical front, for example. Mm. And you look at the kind of stuff that they're working on at MIT. And when I was at over in December, I always make my annual pilgrimage to Stanford. I just walk around because such a cool place. But 2 years ago, we went on this trip. I went with a bunch of tech entrepreneurs involved in the medical field and discovery, and we had access to the most amazing, mind-blowing scientists that were telling us about the stuff that they're busy with at the moment. And they were like talking about big data and you know, you can now put these predictive models, right? When you arrive in a hospital, you arrive in the emergency in the hospital and they start plugging in stuff to give you a heart rate and that sort of thing. That stuff then sends the data through to another server that's got already existing data on your history, your medical history, depending on what trauma you've just suffered and why you're in that particular trauma room. They're able to start predicting, like within days, how long it's going to take before you die.
Wow.
You know, just based on your condition, your age, your current heart rate, that this person at sugar level, and if that happened, this is the shock that his system has had, and because of that shock, you know, it's stuff that doctors can't work out. We don't have the human capacity to do that in that space, that space of time. So when you've got the technology starting to say, hey, why don't you guys try this on Rayhard? You might save his life. Then it gets exciting. Then I want to share my data. But what is, say, Discovery, or what is the hospital going to do with the data and the doctors that are sharing the data? And who has access to that data? Because we haven't even touched on the medical record side of things. But if it can be used, it's a catch-22 situation. Mm. If it can be used to say, they know about Aki, that if he does arrive in the hospital with a certain outcome, we know how we can possibly save his life. Yeah. Because what happens is AI then has a certain bias to people. Because what happens if that person that's sitting in the emergency room, and there are two people that have arrived at the same time? I know that Rayhard's funds are running a little bit low in his medical aid. Aki's funds are looking pretty good at the moment. We're going to be guaranteed of our money from Aki's funds. So let's rather save his life first before we save Rayhard's life. So when AI starts having certain biases based on what this current situation is like, then it does get scary for me. And let's not forget that all of this code, all of this AI is written by human beings.
Yeah, yeah. That's
and there's machine learning and all sorts of things.
That's a conversation that you can – I think that's an entire episode there, just what, you know, what the machine – the evolution of the machine and the AI.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, AI for me is playing a very particular – or can play a very particular role in this whole data scenario. AI could be an independent body. 100%. AI could be something that is the gatekeeper to all the data without human intervention or human greed coming in to try and maybe –
But it's
got to
be regulated.
If AI gets to a point where it'll have to be regulated, I guess. But if AI can make those decisions again, gatekeeping the information, not what to do with the information. That would be another AI bot, I would assume.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like an API call.
Yeah.
Who can get the right data at the right time? Not just any political party wants to then push those specific ads. Although, having said that, you can push a lot of ads just using Facebook's ad tools to a lot of demographics already.
Exactly.
I can only imagine the kind of stuff that they could get into with the unrestricted data.
Yeah.
That is scary stuff.
And also, you know, how you manipulate the news. I mean, that's, you know, the news manipulates people. It manipulates the way you think, even in this country. If you read some of the conversations on Facebook and on Twitter, and you think, are you really believing what you've just tweeted about the economy or about this person, or whatever the case may be. where people can influence. If you repeat things enough times to a human being, you'll start believing it, even though it might not be true.
Again, coming back to this Darren Brown episode.
Exactly.
You know, you can manipulate. The human being is a very soft and fragile thing, and you can get manipulated with anything. And
that's the one thing that freaks me about this, the future and AI and analytics, and freaks me out.
We're in for a very, very interesting time.
Are you real? Are you not a cyborg?
I could be a VR. Well, we wouldn't know, right?
Dude, I was watching over the weekend one of the big universities done a robot that mimics, and they're getting very close to, you know, human
full
robots,
facial
full
look,
facial.
Yeah.
And this robot was mimicking the other person's facial expressions like super real, man. He was going like frowning or smiling on. And the motors and the sensors inside this robotic face were mimicking it, and they obviously had the right, you know, the gray hair and the human. It looked very, very human. It looked like a real human being. But it was mimicking another person's human emotions. I was like sitting at watching this with my mouth
that
open.
And I think in a closing note from me, In that vein, too, what is very scary for me is the software version of that, where they could now, with software, video and audio, you can make anybody say anything, because you've got now everybody that's in the public space, like a politician.
Yes.
You can feed all those recordings of their speeches in, and this computer program will make them look and say, you know, just like they were talking in one of those press meetings, for example.
A great example of this timeline that we're talking about is Ibo's dog, Sony's Ibo's dog.
Oh, yeah.
Now, when that dog was first introduced, I think, you know, like 20 years ago, just over 20 years ago, you know, at the time, it was simply a robotic dog. It had sensors that was going woof, woof, and doing all sorts of things. And Sony sold thousands of them, okay? And then at some point, 10 years ago, to be exact, I think the dog is about 30 years old, if I'm not mistaken. But 10 years ago, they said, okay, we're making the last Ibo. It's not, you know, profitable enough for us, and you know, we're not doing these anymore. And they relaunched this dog, this Ibo dog. It's now become another big sensation. They had it at CS. And I was talking to the one Sony executive. I said, but you guys, 10 years ago, you stopped making this dog, and now you're making it again. Why? He says, because the technology has advanced so much that we're able to put in AI and software in this dog that brings out so much human emotion and mimics human beings that we didn't have access to that technology. That's how fast technology has jumped in just a decade. We've got access to the cloud, access to artificial intelligence. And he says that this dog is not just a dog that we've pre-programmed to do things. The dog is now learning from you as a human being and adapts to you. So the dog starts knowing what time you're coming home. It's accessing certain of your music libraries. It's almost becoming human-like, but it won't become as human-like as a real dog. We know that. Mm. But it's able to pick up on your emotions and react accordingly just from the artificial intelligence that it's got, something that Sony didn't have 10 years ago. Hence the reason why they've reintroduced Ibo the dog in the world in 2018. And you can't buy them for the love of money. They're the most difficult thing to get.
Yeah, and you don't. They don't sell them anywhere outside of Japan, I believe.
No, but
or China. Where they manufacture?
Japan. Yeah. But you know, I'm sure they're going to roll out more. I mean, the initial batch is gone, but it's a fascinating little toy.
Yeah, AI again. AI electronics making all of this happen. And let's not forget that our brains, what we are, is essentially made up of binaries, bits, atoms, ins and outs. You know, we're not so far from these things if we drill down deep into the most fundamental level of what we really are.
I've been told that there's an empty vacuum where my brain is.
Well, then there's lots of space for upgrades then.
Yes.
Well, on that fantastic note, Aki, thank you so much for coming and spending some time with us.
It was so cool to catch up again, man.
Thank you very much. I've learned a lot, and it certainly won't be the last
fantastic
time I do this.
And listen, I'm loving what you're doing with drones at the moment. Eh?
Thank you.
We haven't
thank
even
you.
Spoken about drones, but I love the drone stuff and the videos that you post. You're really getting the hang of it, you know. And
thank you.
And I'm just loving the stuff with drones. I think that's another massive market.
It's a passion. Yeah, look, I've got a little something for you when we finish this podcast for you to play with. And then I think once you've got your teeth cut on some drones, let's have another chat and see what your opinion is on them.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Aki. I really appreciate it. We'll see you again soon. This is Rehot coming to you from the Best in Tech. Thank you so much for tuning in. Remember, we come to you every week on the Tech Central podcast network. Until next time. Cheers.